Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And when the first images from the Haiti earthquake began arriving here in the U.S., they were not from professional photojournalists, but from regular folks right on the scene. Cell phone cameras, Flickr uploads, YouTube videos. New technology has blurred the line between amateur and professional. Add to that the ability of anyone, professional or amateur, to manipulate images on your desktop, and we're living in a highly changed photo environment from a few years ago. And that's the environment that Fred Richin tries to get his head around in a new book called After Photography. Richin is the former New York Times Magazine photo editor and currently teaches at NYU. Fred Richin, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, glad to be here.
And listeners, we're going to focus this discussion on some actual examples from Fred's book, which we've posted in a slideshow on our blog. So if you want to follow along with the images, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you'll be able to see them. And if you're not near a computer, rest assured, Fred and I are very good at describing visuals. And we also have a call-in question for you. We're going to start talking to Fred about one image from Haiti, and then meet New York photojournalist Matt McDermott, who traveled to Haiti and took one of the most iconic images from the aftermath of the quake. You may know it. It's the photo that ran in the New York Post of a boy being pulled from the rubble, arms outstretched, surrounded by rubble and rescue workers. But we want to know what you think is the defining image from Haiti. Do you have one from this disaster? Tell us what image you think of that you've seen anywhere after the earthquake's devastation. 212-433-WNYC if anyone has one. 212-433-9692 or post on our comments page. And Fred, let's start with one image from Haiti that you've written about on your blog. It's image number one on the slideshow if you're on our site, and
yep,
it ran in Time magazine. Describe it for us.
Well, it's a man walking out. He's described as a looter who runs away with goods stolen from damaged building in Port-au-Prince, and he's got something white on his face, and it kind of looks a bit ominous, exotic, sinister, and so on. And what was interesting to me was to find out from the photographer that he's actually wearing toothpaste on his face as a way of masking the smell of the decay. It's really not ominous at all. It's just a guy, you know, taking three boxes. And it's the same issue as with Katrina. Are these people looters if they're trying to survive, or are these people actually needing stuff? To, you know, some are, some aren't, but how do you differentiate?
And so do you think this is indicative of the state of photojournalism in some way?
Yeah, I think it's indicative in the sense that we're almost always looking for the photographs of shock and the sensational and the amazing, you know, to rivet the viewer's attention, considering that we have these billions of images at this point to choose from. We're trying for that single knockout image, and we're, in doing so, often missing context.
There's that old adage that a picture's worth a thousand words, but you seem to be saying that here the caption is the defining factor.
It often is, and also our preconceptions. You know, we look at it as, you know, this right-wing radio is telling us that people deserve these terrible catastrophes, they did something wrong, here they're looters, they're not good people, and it falls into certain kinds of preconceptions. And I think what photography should really do is open our minds and not, you know, keep something going that we already have in our minds.
Once you see the word looting, it's going to form your impression of the visual. Let's move on to two more images, numbers two and three, for those of you on our page. And as we said, we'll return to Haiti with Matt McDermott in a minute. But for now, we have two unrelated photos. Most everyone is familiar with this. It's the covers of Time and Newsweek from the summer of 1994. One is the mugshot of O.J. Simpson. The other is the mugshot, but highly manipulated. It makes him look darker. And this, of course, garnered a lot of controversy at the time, obviously. Was this the first time that problems with digital manipulation came up in the national conversation, Fred?
No, I think in 82, National Geographic moved a cover picture of the pyramids of Giza. They put one behind the other, which was certainly less of a manipulation than what we're looking with Simpson. But that was revealed a couple years later, and that was really the beginning of the national conversation on, is digital manipulation going to really minimize the impact of photography? What's it going to do to it? Are we going to keep our credibility? And it's now, what, almost 30 years later, and we still really don't have a handle on it.
But one of the things you point out in your book, After Photography, is that both news and art photographers have always looked to manipulate their images. When you go into a dark room, you make certain decisions about how to present a photograph. You know, that's the old photography.
Yeah, but they would darken the sky a little bit or lighten it or something of that nature. It's true, there were composites from time to time, but not with this frequency, not on the covers of magazines. You know, we now have potential laws in France and Britain because there's so many women whose bodies are being changed digitally that they're afraid of, you know, issues like anorexia. So that never happened 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago. This extent, this frequency, this scale never happened before.
Digital tools just make it so easy.
Right.
So on to image four. This is Spencer Platt's photograph, which was selected as the 2006 World Press Photo of the Year. The original caption read, "Affluent Lebanese drive down the street to look at a destroyed neighborhood." Describe this one for listeners who aren't seeing it and explain why you included it in the book.
Well, it's a picture of five young people in a sports car going down a road in Beirut after the Israeli bombardment, and there's destroyed buildings and people walking by, and the photographer had the impression that these people were kind of wealthier people, you know, violence tourists, basically. But in fact, because of the worldwide spread of the web and so on and so forth, these people were tracked down, and it turned out they lived there. They were just coming back to see what happened to their building. So it's often the foreign photographer who may not speak the language, who may not know the customs, who has certain assumptions, just like in Haiti, and brings those assumptions to us. And what's interesting here is there's a young woman in the car with her own cell phone camera making her own video, and what interested me very much would be the ability to click on that image and then see her viewpoint on it. What does an insider see versus just the outsider, which gets to the issue of citizen journalism.
True, and it's all very meta in that photograph for that reason. But after that photograph got so much attention, there were follow-up interviews done of the women in the shot, and there was no digital manipulation being taken place of the image, but the subject certainly felt manipulated, which I guess raises the question, what's the responsibility of a photojournalist to think about how an image will be received? Obviously, this is a very compelling image, and it's real. So is Spencer Platt's job simply to snap the best picture he sees at any given moment and not worry about how it might be interpreted, or is it more than that?
It has to be more than that. The photojournalist has to be the author of their own imagery, just the way somebody working in text or film, it's the same thing. And you're responsible that it's contextualized as well as it can be, knowing that there are editors and others who may, you know, change it. But you really have to, your obligation is to the people in the picture. Many people think their obligation is to the kind of commercial aspects of the newspapers, magazines that need to shock and so on. But I think the final obligation is that you represent correctly the people in the pictures as well as you possibly can, knowing that you don't always know the language and it's maybe a war situation, it may be difficult to ask questions, but you really have to do that. Otherwise, it's not really witnessing.
And again, listeners, if you want to see this slideshow, mostly of photojournalism examples, digital photojournalism examples from Fred Richin's book, After Photography. You can see the slideshow that our producer, Jody Evergan, put together right on our page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show and kind of follow along. And back to Haiti for our final three images. Images five and six are actually from Haiti in 1994, from the U.S. invasion of the country to restore Aristide to power. And we see the same image from two angles. Talk about the context.
Well,
this is a good one, by the way, for people who can't see them. This one we really need to compare.
Right. The official image, the image people would have seen, is the American soldiers landing at the airport. They're prone. They have their guns ready to fire. They're behind their backpacks. There's a helicopter behind them, and you kind of feel this sense of invasion. And it's almost like a World War II John Wayne image. But if you look from the side, the second image, which is by Alex Webb, a Magnum photographer, you see the same soldiers from the side, and in front of them is something about a dozen photographers shooting at them with their cameras. So the only ones doing the shooting are the photographers, not the soldiers. And it's a misrepresentation because you have a sense that in front of them is the enemy, but in front of them is a dozen photographers, which is often what happens when photographers, you know, travel in packs. I refer to this as a photo opportunity. I was corrected by a photographer in the picture who said it's not a photo opportunity, it's really a gangbang. It's the sense that, you know, they travel in packs for protection, for economical reasons and so on, and make the same sorts of images that are completely misleading.
So now to our last image, and this photo taken very recently. And now let's welcome Chris McDermott. Matt McDermott. He's a New York-based photojournalist who went to Haiti and came away with this image. Matt, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. And you know what? I want to match you up with a caller who we asked people to call in with the photos from Haiti that they see as the most iconic. And one of the callers actually picked your shot. So let's talk to Ivan at the NYU Medical Center. Ivan, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you for the wonderful job you're doing. Yes, Matt, the picture that you have of Kiki, that little boy, it was on the best picture in Haiti, because the reason I love that picture, I can see on his environment, the fireman next to him spread his arm the same way Kiki spread his arm. That showed the value of life. He's happy. He said, thank you for saving me. The happiness and everybody surrounding him is very happy. And something else, before you take that picture, I remember him putting his pants up, his pants was going down, and to show the dignity of that little boy. I remember very well. His pants was down, and then when they lift him up, he reached his pants to say, hey, I don't have to be naked for anybody to see me. The kid is happy. By the way, I saw his picture again last week in the CNN. He gained 10 pounds.
Ah, that's great. Ivan, Yvonne, thank you very much.
Yeah,
and there
thank you,
is,
Ivan. Thank you very much.
Matt, there's this beautiful symmetry for people who can't see it of the gesture that the boy is making and that one of the rescue workers is making almost as an instinctive response. Did you notice that as you were taking the picture?
In the situation, I was shooting wide because, there was sort of a general circle around the spot where I was predicting he was going to be pulled from, obviously where they were working. And, I was wanting to shoot wide because I knew that there would be some sort of emotional response from everybody else. What kind of response, you don't know. I mean, you can't predict it, but you got to sort of try to be, ready for what's going to happen. And, if you shoot too tight, then you lose that. So, I took a risk going wide, and it worked out. I mean, sometimes, kind of luck sort of falls on your shoulder.
Tequila in Soho has an iconic Haiti image. Hello, Tequila.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you. What are you looking at?
I just came back on Saturday. I was there during the earthquake.
Mm-hmm. And? And what did you want to say about photos? You had photos published, right?
Yeah, well, my photos were the first ones, or one of the first ones that got out. So the idea of digital imagery that enabled us to get the pictures out immediately. I think my pictures were on the web 2 hours after the earthquake.
Tequila, thank you for calling. Linda in Brooklyn, you had a Haiti photo.
Okay.
Linda, you there?
Yes, I am.
Which one?
The photo of a toddler in the New York Times being readied for evacuation from Haiti with his father standing nearby. And the little child was looking at his, you could just see him watching his father very anxiously, knowing he's going to be leaving him, with a doctor standing over him. That one really got me.
Thank you for your call. Matt McDermott, when you're in Haiti taking pictures in this kind of a crisis, earlier we discussed this question of so-called looting and the context that photos from Haiti and other disaster areas provide. Was that something that was on your mind as you were snapping away? And this whole conversation that we've been having with Fred Richin about how even photojournalists with the best of intentions often wind up either manipulating or misleading their subjects or their readers.
You know what? I mean, the greatest, you got to try to be as truthful and as responsible to the subject matter and to the people that you're photographing and the environment you're photographing. What happens with it after? I mean, that's when things get really funky. I've been back, took a look at some of the sort of quote interviews that were done with me, and these were interviews that I never had with organizations or newspapers. The facts are all incorrect. So what happens after, especially with the internet and the pirating of photographs? The best that we can do is to be as factual and as honest with our cameras, as far as on the ground and in the situation. And, it's unfortunately a still photo nowadays can be so manipulated. You can take a person that's laughing for hours, and that one moment he puts his hand on his face and sort of, drops his head. You take that frame, and it looks like he's in sadness.
We just have a few seconds left, and listeners, again, you can go and see this slideshow of Matt's photograph from Haiti and others, mostly from Fred Richin's new book, After Photography, at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Fred, just take 15 seconds here and tell us about the title. Why After Photography instead of During Photography?
Because photography, as Matt was just saying, has lost a lot of its credibility. It's not automatically evidence of something the way it used to be. It's not a footprint from reality the way Susan Sontag called it anymore. So if it's not that automatic recording device that everybody believes and has that credibility, then we have to kind of reinvent the medium and move forward and figure out with the digital, you know, how to rethink the entire medium and other media so that they're more effective.
Fred Richin,
it's a transitional point.
Fred Richin and Matt McDermott, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. And Fred, good luck on the book.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.